Hamish Ramsden was a 31-year-old Hawke's Bay farmer, his wife 6 months pregnant, when his life changed forever. While taking a calf's ear, its protective mother charged Hamish, hitting him mid-chest and knocking him backwards, dislocating his neck. On that day in 1994, the keen runner, tennis and rugby player and active farmer became a tetraplegic with no feeling from the nipple line down. Hamish Ramsden went on to develop a sheep stud with one of his brothers, which grew into the largest privately owned sheep and cattle genetics company in New Zealand. He stepped back from that business now, but has several directorships with private companies, has been involved in the Burwood Spinal Unit Education Group, is on the technical committee for wheelchair standards, and for the last 11 years, he's worked as a teacher aide at a Christchurch school, working with children with learning difficulties. Hamish has just published a memoir called Dogs Getting Fat, all proceeds going to the New Zealand Spinal Trust and the Catwalk Trust. And he's with me now. Kia ora, Hamish.
Yeah, morning, Lynn.
Crikey, it's a brave and honest account of living with tetraplegia. And you write in the preface that after each writing session, you felt like you'd been beaten up, revisiting those tough times. What made you continue?
I don't really know. I never set out to actually write a book. I just wanted to put it down on paper because I quite enjoy writing. But I guess once I started, I thought, well, I might as well just keep going and at least get it down on paper. But I really had no further ambition at that stage to take it any further.
I know that you worked very closely with your daughter Tessa on this, and she encouraged you to keep going.
She did. It was really important to me that she was okay with the whole project, because a lot of it's quite raw, it's quite gnarly stuff, and she was too young to have remembered the stuff that we went through. And so because of that, and a lot of it was hard stuff to deal with, I wanted her acceptance of it, and it was okay to put it out there. Otherwise, I never would have gone all the way through with it.
You were close anyway, but I got a sense that this has somehow brought you closer together, because, as you say, it's helped her understand what you've gone through and what happened before she could possibly have known.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, we're a lot closer. And to me, that's the real benefit of the whole project, is that we are a lot closer and a lot more in tune with each other. And look, she's brilliant, and she helped me get it through to that final stage, which was fantastic.
As you say, it is gnarly and it is tough. And for her to read, because you're very candid about your anger and the pain that you felt and the frustration and those down times, that would be hard for a daughter to read.
Oh, look, I don't deny that at all. And it was hard enough for me to revisit those times, and because you sort of think, well, why do I want to go there? I've got through it, and I've coming out the other end, and I don't know whether I'll actually ever come out the other end, but to revisit it. But for her to just, I guess, to see a lot of that emotional and raw stuff for one of your parents, it can't have been easy for her at all.
Well, and I'm sorry to do this to you, but let's go back to 1994 and when the accident happened. I mean, you remember parts of it clearly, and others you describe as a bit of a blur, but what are your abiding memories of what happened?
Well, I remember vividly going into the paddock and parking up the four-wheeler, and it was a case of marking any calves that had been born within the last 24 hours, and that involved putting a tag in their ear just for identification purposes. So I remember holding the calf, and then a little bit blurry as to what happened next, other than the fact that I remember flying backwards and then sort of rolling, being up and then down, and then just lying there and really worried about what was going to happen next, because it was pretty obvious to me that I was paralysed, because I couldn't move, but I couldn't see where the cow was and whether she was backing up for another charge or what. So it was fairly tense moment.
Amazing too, when you're writing about trying to get your dog to leave you. I mean, the dog's instincts, of course, are to come to be with its masters. But, you were trying to get the dog to leave in case it brought the cow back.
Well, the cow, it was just doing a protective mum thing, like any mother would do. If you thought your child was in danger or pain, you'd look to protect them. And cows have a natural aversion to dogs, I guess, because the dogs chase them and round them up all the time. And so I was lying there and I heard a sniffling sound, and I wasn't sure whether it was the cow backing up for another charge. And then, as I say in the book, I got a big sloppy lick on my cheek, and it was my dog just doing the friendly the dog thing. And so I was really worried that the cow would go into protective mode again and want to charge the dog. And if the dog was right next to me, then obviously charged me again. So I yelled at it as best I could to go and get up on the four-wheeler, which I hoped it was far enough away from both of us so that the cow wouldn't feel the need to charge again.
There's a bit of almost laugh-out-loud stuff when you're describing what happened, in that your neighbour, Mike, comes along and wants to help. I think he used the word, he was blithering, which was a little bit tough. But he didn't know how to help you, and he was asking you what to do.
Oh, he was hopeless. He just, like, he was driving home at the end of the day, and he obviously saw me lying in the middle of the paddock, so he came running over to see what was happening. And it was fairly obvious to me, as I said, that I was paralysed or there was something pretty serious going on. And he was just sort of running around, what do I do? Well, you need to go and get on the phone and ring the rescue helicopter. How do I do that? You need a phone. You need the numbers 111, and you better get going. And what do I say to them? So it was all just, really, here I am lying in the paddock. Do I have to do all the thinking? He was the one who was panicking, and I was cool, calm, and collected, which was a complete reverse of what it should have been.
I was astonished that the decision wasn't made to instantly send the rescue helicopter to you.
Yeah, it didn't sort of hit me at the time, other than the fact that, really, I mean, it's pretty obvious that I can't move and something's pretty seriously wrong. But whether they'd been stung before and caught out with a lot of false alarms, and I imagine it's fairly expensive to put the helicopter in the air, but, that necessitated another 40-minute wait for the ambulance to come out from Dannevirke, which is the nearest town. And looking back, it was a complete waste of time, really, when that first hour, at least after your accidents, the golden hour, as they call it.
You did eventually make it to the Burwood Spinal Unit, and that description of the actions that they took straight away, even screwing things into your skull and attaching traction weights. Talk us through that.
Well, yeah, because I flew from Palmerston North Hospital down to Christchurch, and basically in the middle of the night, and then had a very slow trip out to the spinal unit in the ambulance, just not wanting to go over bumps and stuff too quickly, and got there and still covered in a fair amount of cow manure. So that firstly had to be cleared off. And the thing with the spinal cord is, once it gets injured, it goes into self-protective mode, and it can actually cause more damage to itself, by trying to do what it thinks is right. So with extra swelling and things like that. So you're trying to minimise any of that overreaction from the body, which necessitates getting into traction, so you're taking the weight off the dislocated spinal cord, and just trying to make sure that you have to have a catheter to put in so your bladder can keep draining. Your body still creates gastric juices in your stomach, so you need a tube put down your throat to be able to syringe those out. So, because the body's just going into overdrive, wondering what the hell's happened to it. So you've got to try and minimise anything else that it needs to do to protect itself.
You had family around you at the start. What were your spirits like in those really early days?
Pretty good, actually. I was just, it was obvious that this is serious stuff. And I never really got, too down and really down and out about it. I guess it was just, righto, this is it. We've always sort of had a bit of a can-do attitude in the family. So what do we need to do? Let's roll up our sleeves and get on with it. You only have so much energy, so let's try and use it for the positive stuff, rather than wallowing in self-pity.
Did the doctors give you any sense of hope, Hamish, that your situation could change? You had some control, I think, of your upper arms, but no finger or hand movement.
Yeah, no, initially I had no movement below my neck, and that increased a little bit to my upper arms. But the doctors No, they came in and said, look, you're never going to walk again, and you're never about to do this or do that because of the level of your injury. And it really just, yeah, it's just, why shut the door? Why turn out the light? Why not say, well, okay, this is what normally happens to someone in your circumstance, but hey, let's see if we can beat the odds. Let's see if we can change this up, rather than just saying, no, that's it, turn out the light, this is what you're going to get or not get.
Well, how much psychological support did you get then and when you left?
Not a hell of a lot. I guess at that stage, you know, they had social workers who were the main ones. They did have a psychologist. But at that stage, I don't know, it either works for you or it doesn't. And a lot of that comes down to the fact of whether you can relate to the person who's meant to be trying to help you. And whether it's my personality or their personality, I'm not sure. I didn't connect with, you know, the social person or social worker who was there or the psychologist. So to me, I didn't really get anything that beneficial out of it. Now, perhaps I should have gone and tried other avenues, but no, that wasn't really that helpful for me at that stage.
There were some things to look forward to. As I mentioned before, your wife Anne was 6 months pregnant when you had your accident. So within a few months, you became a dad to Tessa. So a really joyful occasion, but it must have been tinged with so much sadness for you.
Oh, look, absolutely. It was it was a real tonic, yeah, because suddenly, you know, all the attention wasn't on me and there was something else really, and it was a positive thing to, you know, when everything else was pretty negative and dire. So it was great to have that something else to focus on, but incredibly hard not to being able to change her nappies, you know, take her out for a walk or just do things on her own. So it was great happiness mixed with, yeah, pretty tense sadness too.
How did people around you, friends, respond to you after your accident? Because it can be quite confronting sometimes. And people, it's like when there's a death, you don't always know what to say or how to help. And that can result in people stepping back.
Absolutely. And by and large, my friends were fantastic. I mean, when I had my accident, I don't even think I knew anyone in a wheelchair. So I've, you know, there were people who didn't respond and I didn't hear from them. That was incredibly sad and hurtful. But I was careful not to judge them too much because I actually don't know how I would have reacted in that situation either. But, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't take much to pick up a phone or put a letter in the mail or something like that. So, yeah, by and large, fantastic. But the one or two that didn't, yeah, it was pretty hurtful.
So what would you say to anyone who's wanting to support a friend or a family member that's had a life-changing accident like this? Like, just treat them like they were before the accident.
Absolutely. Yep. Just, they're still the same person. They just, you know, have changed because their body doesn't work or part of it doesn't work or, you know, they've got an illness or whatever. So, you know, they desperately want to be normal. In my case, I wanted to be normal, although, you know, at times I think normal is boring, but they're still the same person. They're just, you know, because of one thing or two things might have changed. So don't shut them out because you need that acceptance. You need to still have that friendship there because, that's what makes up a lot of life, really.
Your marriage didn't survive, and you write about this really sensitively in the book, but that was clearly a really, really tough time for you.
Oh, look, absolutely. And I don't blame Anne, my wife, for leaving. It was an incredibly hard situation, you know, and suddenly been dealt cards that no one in any situation would want. So it was, do I wish it didn't happen? Obviously I do. And seeing Tessa grow up from afar was incredibly hard. But do I blame her for leaving? No, not at all.
You started working with one of your brothers, Andy, who developed a sheep stud. Tell me about the business.
Oh, look, it was great. I was fourth generation on the family farm, and when we came to sell it was incredibly hard on me, but particularly my parents because they'd spent the last 50 years developing it. But it's important at that stage that I still had a connection with the rural industry. And Andy, my brother, was farming next door, and was setting up a sheep stud. So I joined forces with him and did all the bookwork, the accountancy and stuff like that, and was a bit of a sounding board for him. So it's just, yeah, you're striving for that normality and getting back into stuff that you're interested in and love. And that was a perfect way for me to be able to continue that interest and give me another focus rather than just inward looking all the time.
I'm talking to Hamish Ramsden, author of Dogs Getting Fat, Living with Tetraplegia. Hamish, you write a lot about carers, and carers clearly are hugely important to you, and the relationship that you have with your carers is really important to you. And you've had some brilliant carers, and you've had some others that you've had to let go. But let's talk through that relationship between someone with tetraplegia and those who care for them.
Yeah, look, you rise and fall on the value and the quality of your carers. I mean, they are my arms and legs, really. And for me to be able to get up and function during the day, I need them to turn up. It's as basic and as simple as that. And I've got fantastic ones at the moment, and particularly Sarah, who I've had a lot for a long time. It's just, you know, fantastic. They allow you to function at whatever level you want to function at. And so, because, you know, I need them to get me up in the morning and to help me into bed at night, you just can't function on a normal daily basis without them. And it's incredibly giving of them. I mean, they are there at your beck and call, you know, so to speak. And they're incredible people, and I just wouldn't survive without them.
Dogs Getting Fat is the name of your memoir. We won't give everything away for the story behind that, but you had your sheepdogs, and certainly there was one of your dogs kept you company for an awful lot of years, and that was a really important relationship too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had my Labrador, Boswell, who was with me through a lot of my transformations, actually, from rural to urban, from able to disabled, he was resilient in his own way, and I guess I fed off that. But just after my accident, I used to wheel as much as I could in my manual wheelchair up and down my drive on the farm. And there was one sheepdog that we didn't sell. He was bloody hopeless as a sheepdog anyway. But used to let him out, and he would just walk up and down while I was going slowly up and down the driveway. And it was incredibly comforting. He wasn't fussed. He didn't need to be out running and chasing stock or chasing rabbits. He just wanted to be with me. So I really tapped into that, and it was a lovely relationship.
You moved to Christchurch and you met a new partner. This was 9 years, I think, after your accident. And that sounds like it was a really wonderful time in your life, but also brought challenges to be, you know, in a relationship, but also to have to be so dependent physically.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, firstly, I was amazed that someone would take me on in my situation. And it's, yeah, so to be part of a family, you know, sort of like family, white picket fence, going to school functions, sports on Saturday, those sorts of things, was incredibly meaningful for me, because I just wanted to experience that part of life. But it's really hard when your partner just has to do everything. And, you know, I just wanted people, you know, in the book to sit back and think, well, okay, what happens, you know, when I want a cup of tea? She has to make it, you know, or you need to light the fire or pull the curtains or drive into town or whatever. They have to do absolutely everything, and there's no let up, and there's no getting away from that. So it was important to me for people, you know, it's very easy to be judgmental and say, why didn't they do this and why didn't they do that? But when you actually have to do everything all the time, it's incredibly draining.
You were in Christchurch for the earthquakes, so terrible for so many people. What was your situation?
Yeah, pretty scary, to be honest. I was in my home office, and I just turned around to work at the desk, and when we got the big shake, and luckily it rocked me side to side in my wheelchair rather than sort of forward and backwards, because I didn't have my seatbelt on around my chest or chest strap at that stage. So, yeah, rocked from side to side, and luckily didn't get thrown out of my chair, because a lot of liquefaction and water started coming through the floor of my office. So that, you know, wouldn't have been a good situation. And basically the bookcase behind me fell down, and I couldn't get out of my office. So I was stuck there until luckily one of my neighbours came and helped me get out of the office and sort of away from buildings and trees in case any of them came down. But yeah, pretty scary because I was so helpless.
And very difficult for you trying to find alternative accommodation.
Oh, incredibly hard. When you imagine there's, and I don't know, you know, say 5,000-10,000 people in Christchurch looking to rent houses because their house is now uninhabitable. And so I turn up at an open home and there might be 20 other couples there. And you think you've got a good chance, and then you just say to the landlord, yeah, I'd love to rent it, but can I shift in 6 weeks' time after I've had the builders in to make an accessible shower and put some ramps in and stuff? And they sort of look at you and go, well, yeah, probably not, because I've got people who want to take it and pay rent straight away. So had to go and camp with my brother down in Wanaka for a couple of months until a house became available, but then shifted five times in the next 5 years because had to keep shifting out of the rentals I was in because they were getting their earthquake alterations done. So a really unsettling time.
Hamish, you spoke before about the lack of support that you felt you had in your early months and years as a tetraplegic. You've been paying it back. You've done a lot over the years to try and help other people with spinal injuries, particularly at Burwood Spinal Education Unit. Talk me through that.
Well, it's really important when you're first injured or newly injured or even further on down the track that you talk to other people who've been down that path before, because they've made the mistakes, they've spent the time working out, you know, what the shortcuts might be. So it's really important for anyone who's new out at the spinal unit to be able to have that access and engagement with old wheelies, if you like. So whatever I could do, you know, whether it was just talking to new people on the ward or educating them about, you know, pain or changing the catheter or bowel routine or any of those sorts of things, it saves them having to spend, you know, all the time making those same mistakes. So the more you can alleviate someone's stress or, you know, uncomfortableness at the time, because you've been through that same situation, well, yeah, and that's very rewarding too, to see, you know, that they can work their way through a situation because of help that you've given them.
You're also on an ethics committee for people doing research on disability issues.
Yeah, it's a committee that we're trying to have the same status as the ethics committee, where researchers will submit their proposal to our committee, and we're all end users. You know, some of us are disabled like myself, some have arthritis, there may be a brain injury or something like that. So we can just say, well, perhaps tinker the research to this way or that way because it'll be more beneficial to the end user. And then hopefully the researcher will make those changes just so that it'll make the research more relevant at the end of the day. So it's still a work in progress, but I think we're making a bit of progress.
You are so open in the memoir that you hate being paralysed. You know, sometimes you read a memoir and there's some kind of resolution at the end saying, I'm actually glad this happened to me because I've become a different person. You hate it, you resent it, it grinds you down every day. And you talk also about day-to-day life. Why did you feel it was so important, Hamish, to be so open on this?
Well, I thought if you're going to put it down on paper, then you might as well just put it down as it is. And I do hate being paralysed. It's a constant pain that is there with me every day. And like any pain, some days it overwhelms you and gets on top of you, and other days it doesn't, and you can function, you know, okay. And so I think it's important for people to understand that. It's not, you know, woe is me and feel sorry for me. I mean, that's a reality of life. And everyone has their own burdens and own things to deal with. But, I think it needed to be realistic if I was going to write about it.
For the last 11 years, you worked with children with learning difficulties at a St Andrews prep school. What do you enjoy about this? Because you clearly do love it.
Oh, look, it's brilliant. And it's a good age group, that sort of 8 to 12-year-olds. They haven't formed their opinions too much. You know, testosterone and puberty's not surging through the veins, and they're really, really open and honest. I mean, I love the honesty of youth. They just look at you and go, "Well, why doesn't that work?" Or why can't you do this? And when I first started there, I expected a lot of questions about the wheelchair. But really, the only two I've had is, what does that button do and how fast does it go? And then it's just, and then it's fine. They just get on with it. Okay, his hands don't work, so I need to pass him that folder and open it here and there. And it's just the brutal honesty and openness around it all that I love.
What are your thoughts on the kind of research? And a lot of research has gone into conditions like yours with tetraplegia for decades now. Do you look ahead and wonder if one day you might be able to walk again?
Look, it will happen, and it's dictated by money, and the money will speed up the time. The reality is there's more money to be made at the moment for, you know, to find a cure for, I don't know, dementia or AIDS or cancer. And so the time frame will be dictated by how much money's put into it. Whether it will be there and available for me in my lifetime, it's probably looking unlikely, but it doesn't mean to say that we don't keep driving and raising as much money as we can to get more money put into research. So it will happen. It's a when rather than an if. And as I say, that when is dictated by money.
I'll share this with you. Your listeners just got in touch to say, your guest says it like it is. Great. Good on him for saying he hates his physical condition and what restriction it gives him. I'm sure we'll get lots more feedback. Hamish Ramsden, thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
And Hamish's book is called Dogs Getting Fat, Living with Tetraplegia.